I'm Tom Hall on 88.1 WIPR. This is Maryland Morning. The public interest lawyer Brian Stevenson says that our criminal justice system treats people who are rich and guilty better than those who are poor and innocent. The Equal Justice Initiative, which he founded, has won the release of more than 115 people who have been wrongfully convicted and sentenced to execution. His advocacy for the poor and people of color who confront unequal treatment in the law has earned him countless accolades and awards and led to a best-selling book. This morning, Brian Stevenson joins me to talk about the power of just mercy. And a star is born in Baltimore. Vivi Etteme is a seventh grader at the Park School. Her talent as a pianist landed her an acting role as the young Nina Simone in a new movie. We'll talk about the journey from the practice room to the silver screen. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick has her weekly review. Nathan's got the local news. First, these headlines.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. Welcome to this special Memorial Day edition of Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Today, we're going to revisit a conversation I had earlier this month with MacArthur Award-winning public interest lawyer Brian Stevenson. When he graduated from Harvard Law School in 1985, he dedicated himself to helping poor and incarcerated people, many of whom were wrongly convicted and condemned to death. In 1989, he founded the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, and he has been a tireless advocate for death row inmates, prisoners with mental illness, and children who have been prosecuted as adults. His work bringing to light the effects of race and poverty in the criminal justice system has earned him dozens of awards, including the National Medal of Liberty and the Olof Palme Prize in Sweden, one of the most prestigious awards for work in international human rights. He's the author of a best-selling book called Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. I reached him on the phone at his office in Montgomery. So in your book, you write that the system treats people who are rich and guilty better than those who are poor and innocent. So you've won legal victories for more than 115 people who've been wrongly condemned to death. You help others who are facing discrimination in the criminal justice system. Talk about the work that you do with the Equal Justice Initiative, who the clients are, and the issues and causes that you take on.
Sure. I mean, I do think that wealth, more than culpability, shapes the outcomes in too many cases, and that's largely because our country has gone through an enormous transformation over the last 50 years. In 1972, we had 300,000 people in jails and prisons, and today we have 2.3 million. And while we have dramatically increased the money we spend on jails and prisons, we've dramatically increased the money we spend on policing and prosecutors and judges, we have not created a corresponding and proportionate increase in the amount that we spend to provide adequate legal representation to the people who are now accused. And so that's how EJI came about. In many states, there are no lawyers for people even on death row. The Supreme Court hasn't recognized the right to counsel after the initial appeals. We have people on death row literally dying for legal assistance. And we started out trying to meet the needs of that population. And once you get into a world like that, you quickly are overwhelmed by all the other people, people wrongly convicted, unfairly sentenced, innocent, who also are desperately in need of legal help. And we've grown to try to meet as many of those needs as we can, but it's still pretty overwhelming.
People use the term systemic racism or structural racism. It's certainly much more nuanced than just simply saying everybody's a racist, although when you in the justice system, but when you read some of the stories that you have in this book, it really does seem like in certain jurisdictions that's absolutely true. What do those terms mean to you, and how might we root them out at some point?
Well, I do think we have a history of racial inequality in this country that we have not adequately addressed. I mean, we have all been infected by a worldview that has tolerated the victimization of people of color. We tolerated a genocide when white settlers came to this continent and millions of native people were slaughtered by famine and disease and war. We tolerated centuries of enslavement that quickly became racialized, where I'm persuaded that the great evil of slavery wasn't just involuntary servitude and forced labor. It was this narrative of racial difference we created. We kind of made up this ideology of white supremacy, and we never really dealt with that. And then we tolerated lynching, thousands of people of color being burned alive and hanged and shot and mutilated, and it was actually racial terrorism for decades that we didn't really address, and then we tolerated decades of legalized racial hierarchy and subordination through Jim Crow statutes and laws that were evident from Maryland to Mississippi, and even after the Civil Rights Act, we still tolerate really disparate treatment in the criminal justice system and in other systems where the poor and people of color are just not treated the same. They're not valued. Their needs and rights aren't protected in the same way. And that's why you have to call this kind of bias structural or systemic. It's been with us so long that there's a kind of bias we call implicit bias, where you're not even consciously aware of the way in which you are presuming the dangerousness or guilt of someone based on their race, based on their color. And all of these things conspire in a criminal justice system where people are at risk of losing their lives or their liberty or their rights or their freedoms. And it's one of the reasons why, if we're going to do something about mass incarceration, we're going to also have to do something about racial inequality.
On 88.1 WIPR, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning is Brian Stevenson. He's the founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative and the author of Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. Ms. Stevenson, here in Baltimore, if people in our city didn't give much thought to the pernicious effects of race and poverty in the criminal justice system before, they most certainly have since the death of Freddie Gray while in police custody just about a year ago. The deaths of several other young black men around the country at the hands of police have given rise to the Black Lives Matter movement and perhaps a new focus on inequality and issues like housing and education and job opportunity in addition to criminal justice. This new activism and groups like Black Lives Matter, do you think that they're bolstering your efforts? And what's your take on the efficacy and the impact of groups like Black Lives Matter?
Well, I think they're playing a critically important role. I mean, because the truth is that people have been talking about these issues for decades. I mean, there was response to police violence in Miami in the 1970s. I mean, we've been looking at this issue of unjustified force against unarmed black and brown people for decades. And it's been difficult to get the media's attention. And one of the things that Black Lives Matter and other organizations have done a good job of is making these issues something that people can access even when mainstream media are not talking about them. But the activism has actually been there for a really long time. We just haven't cared enough to respond to these problems. And ultimately, that's what we're going to have to do. We're going to have to create a commitment to the rule of law, to protecting the rights of all people equally, if we're going to see real progress on these issues. But I think it's important that we talk more about questions of racial bias and bias against the poor and disfavored groups, because if we're not vigilant about those protections, you know, we replicate the mistakes that we claim to have overcome.
So the path out of this entrenched racism and unequal treatment of poor and people of color, it's not just legal victories like the ones that you're amassing, you know, day after day, week after week. It's not just one legal victory at a time. It's really, you're really calling for a more holistic approach.
I am, yes. We have actually, we continue to fight in court on behalf of our clients. We continue to ask the Supreme Court and local trial courts to intervene and protect the rights of our clients. But we've actually started, you know, talking more broadly, we have a project where we are putting markers at lynching sites all over this country. We erected markers in Montgomery to acknowledge the Montgomery slave trade and the spaces where slave warehouses existed and slave auctions took place. We're doing projects that are aimed at changing this narrative of racial difference. We're building a museum that will be called From Enslavement to Mass Incarceration. We're actually creating a space that will be a memorial where the history of racial inequality can be confronted. I think if you go to South Africa, they will tell you they could not recover from apartheid without a process of truth and reconciliation. In Rwanda, they say the same thing following the genocide. I look at the nation state of Germany and how the landscape is covered with these totems and stones and markers that reflect the places where Jewish families were abducted during the Holocaust. The Germans actually want you to go to Auschwitz and Birkenau to reflect soberly on that legacy. We do the opposite in America. We've largely ignored or denied all of the damage that was done by slavery and lynching and segregation. We have not marked the spaces. We have not facilitated that truth and reconciliation process. And I think the death of people like Freddie Gray and countless others is a symptom of our failure to deal with this underlying disease. And so for us at EJI, that becomes a huge priority.
Michelle Alexander, who's a friend and acquaintance of yours, to be sure, she has written so powerfully about the new Jim Crow in America, incarceration rates, and that very potent subject. You have to prioritize in this day and age. I mean, what fundamental problems in the criminal justice system strike you as the single most urgent that need to be addressed right away?
Well, I think there are three for me. I think, number one, we have to declare an end to the war on drugs and begin dealing with drug addiction and drug dependency as a health problem rather than a crime problem. We have hundreds of thousands of people in jails and prisons that don't have to be there because they're not a threat to public safety. And they wouldn't be there if we were just more informed about how to deal with that issue. I think, number two, we've got to eliminate excessive punishment. We have so many punishments in this country that are excessive, that don't make any sense at all. I'm currently representing a man who's 75 years old. He's a disabled combat veteran who was convicted of being in possession of marijuana for his personal use, and he was given a mandatory sentence of life imprisonment without parole. And we have those kinds of sentences where even the trial judges say, this is not a fair sentence, but I don't have the discretion to sentence you fairly. And these kinds of mandatory three-strike sentences, life sentences for writing a bad check, I think have to be eliminated, as well as the extreme sentences that we impose for a range of offenders, including children and the mentally ill. And then the third thing is I think we have to create a different economic incentive around incarceration. We went from $6 billion in 1980 on jails and prisons that we spent to $80 billion last year. And a lot of those billions are going to private industries that have an incentive to keep the prison population high,
right,
to block criminal justice reform.
Right, and
that has to change.
And we'll talk more about that after a break for the news, if I can indulge you to stick around a little bit. We appreciate it. We'll talk more. The public interest lawyer, Brian Stevenson, will have more with Mr. Stevenson after a break for the news. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're listening to a conversation I had earlier this month with MacArthur Award-winning founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, Brian Stevenson. His book is called Just Mercy. He joined me on the phone from his office in Montgomery, Alabama. So let's talk about the issue of incarceration. A lot of people, from President Obama to scholars to community activists and others, have decried the incredibly high rates of incarceration in the United States compared to the rest of the world, particularly in communities of color. So some folks are saying that progress is being made. I mean, do you think that the trend is changing? Are you seeing the needle move?
Yeah, I am. I mean, we've certainly seen a leveling of these dramatic increases in the rate of incarceration over the last 30 years. And I think that is a function of our just coming to terms with we went too far. We were really reactionary. I think we were led by what I call the politics of fear and anger. And we had politicians from both political parties competing with one another over who could be the toughest on crime. And it was sort of a race to the bottom when it came to rational sentencing and fair administration of criminal justice. And I think we have thrown so many people in jails and prisons. You know, there's 6 million people on probation or parole. 70 million Americans have criminal arrests, that eventually a wider segment of the American population began to recognize the threat posed by a society that now has the highest rate of incarceration in the world. I think that, combined with the 2008 recession, where states had to finally think about the cost of putting so many people in jails and prisons, has created a new conversation. You see it happening in Congress, where people from both political parties are now talking about the need to bring down the prison population. You're seeing it in some really conservative states like Texas and South Carolina and Mississippi. California voters repealed three strikes laws a couple of years ago. So I am encouraged, but we still need more leadership. We still need more commitment from our elected officials to commit to policing strategies that are designed to, at the beginning, gain trust and legitimacy with the communities that are the most policed. You cannot, go into communities where you have menaced and targeted and threatened people for decades and expect cooperation and respect until you change things. And that's part of what I think needs to happen, along with a more responsive criminal justice system to the problems of marginalized communities in a whole host of spaces.
You're right, and others have observed as well that the current prison population, 2.3 million people, more than 50% of those folks, so it's more than a million people, suffer from mental illness, yet they're incarcerated, and oftentimes it's because of their mental illness that they're either unable or just legal assistance is unavailable to them, and obviously it could also influence whatever crime they may have committed.
Yeah, I mean, we understandably wanted to deinstitutionalize those awful institutions that were evidenced in the 1930s and 40s that became warehouses for people with mental illness, and more importantly, people who were not mentally ill, but just doing things that violated social or cultural norms. We were putting people in interracial relationships into those asylums. We were putting people who were gay or lesbian, and there was a lot of abuse, but that effort to deinstitutionalize left no place for the poor mentally ill and the poor mentally disabled to get care and treatment. And sadly, the criminal justice system has stepped in, swept these people up, convicted them of crimes, and often subjected them to sentences that are mandatory sentences where their mental health or their mental disability can't even be considered. And now we have chronic problems of really abusive conditions of confinement. So I do think we need to reevaluate the way we are managing and addressing mental illness in this country, particularly in the criminal justice system.
So much of your book is about the death penalty and your work in that arena. You write very compellingly about a rather celebrated case of a man named Walter McMillan, who was unjustly convicted of a murder in 1988. I was surprised to learn that 1 in 10 people exonerated of a crime who were on death row pleaded guilty to the crime. 1 in 10, they pleaded
yeah.
guilty. And so is it just a matter of good lawyering to get those confessions thrown out or convince juries otherwise?
Well, I think it is one of the problems we have. We have a system that tolerates a lot of unreliability, a lot of unfairness. We don't provide people with the representation that they need. We then really turn up the volume in terms of anger and hostility toward the rights of those folks. Our courts have shifted to a landscape where they prioritize finality over fairness. And the consequence is that you have a system of imposing the death in this country that is highly unreliable. Now, for every 9 people we've executed, we've now identified 1 innocent person on death row who's been exonerated. There are over 156 innocent death row prisoners like Walter McMillan, the man I write about, who have been released from death row after being proved innocent. And yet, despite that high rate of error, you still have states routinely scheduling execution dates after taking on no reform, no review, no reconsideration. And that's why I really do believe that the death penalty in this country is a topic that can't be evaluated by asking whether people deserve to die for the crimes they've committed. I think the question we have to ask is, do we deserve to kill when we tolerate unfairness, when we tolerate bias, when we tolerate discrimination against the poor, when we tolerate unreliability and wrongful convictions? And that's been the gist of why we have been pushing so hard for repeal of the death penalty.
Brian Stevenson is the founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. You write that the title of your book is Just Mercy. And you write towards the end of your book, the power of just mercy is that it belongs to the undeserving. So I wonder, are you optimistic that we could get to that level of compassion, that level of understanding, particularly in the context of the fear and the anger that is being, that is such a big dimension of the current political discourse and has been a part of the political discourse in this country for the past, many decades?
Yeah, I am, because I think the truth of it is that we all want compassion. We all want mercy when we make mistakes. None of us want to be judged by the worst thing we've ever done. If we've ever told a lie, we don't want to always be known as only a liar. And I think that desire to recover, that desire for redemption, that desire for a second chance, that desire for mercy resides in all of us. And if we want it for ourselves, we have to be willing to give it to other people. And the metric we have to use to dictate when we give it cannot be whether the person deserves it. Because if they deserve it, it's not really mercy. It's not really compassion. And so I do think we have all of these faith institutions in America that are organized around this idea of redemption and recovery. In every faith community, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, and Buddhism, whatever, there is this quest for recovery and redemption. So I think the human struggle has been marked by its enduring commitment to mercy and compassion. It's just been interrupted in our country by the politics of fear and anger, by this instinct to punish and condemn, to kind of throw away the broken things around us. And so I think we have to just engage people in a more complete way, in a more holistic way, to understand that if you throw away the broken, if you throw away those who fall down, if you condemn people to their worst act, you condemn yourself. You create a world where you will not have the space to be fully human because you'll be reduced in that same way. And I don't think many of us want to live in that kind of world.
In 2010, half the number of people were executed by the state than were executed in 1999. The trend seems to be headed downward. Do you think that the environment is beginning to be conducive to a national repeal of the death penalty?
I hope so. I do think we've seen real progress. We've seen states, well, like Maryland and Illinois and states across this country abolish the death penalty. And I think that those developments do signal that we want something a little more effective than just the promise of an extreme punishment that has no real impact on violent crime. I mean, we waste a lot of money on the death penalty. California has the largest death row in the country. They spend about $200 million a year on a death penalty with very little to show for it. And I think most people in California, if they knew the facts, would say, well, should we spend $1 billion on the death penalty over the next 5 years? Or should we spend that on public safety? Should we spend that on trying to create systems and circumstances and law enforcement and safety policies that help us? And I don't think it's an irrational choice to say, no, of course we want to spend that money differently. So I'm hopeful. One of the challenges that we have is creating the right environment to have honest discourse. Most of our discourse on crime has been compromised and distracted by, the anger, the rhetoric, the extreme attitudes that have largely influenced these policies. But I'm increasingly hopeful that that can be countered with a vision that's a little more hopeful, a little more transformative than what we've gotten from the death penalty in this country over the last 40 years.
You have a lot of clients who are children, and you write very compellingly about a number of kids that you've represented. One is a young guy named Joe Sullivan. He was incarcerated for more than 18 years with adults when he was 13 years old, and you write about a lot of kids who get put in adult prisons and in solitary confinement. President Obama has just issued, I guess, an executive order disallowing that in federal prisons. But are there still kids being put in solitary confinement? There's one kid you write about who's there. I think his name is Ian Nunez, maybe, who was Ian Manuel, who was there. Ian Manuel is his name. He was there for 14 years.
Yeah. No, tragically, it is still a problem, and it's one of the most heartbreaking problems that we face. You know, the Congress passed something called the Prison Rape Elimination Act about 14 years ago that prohibits these policies, but they didn't create any enforcement mechanism. And so on any given day, the Bureau of Justice predicts that there are about 10,000 children in adult jails and prisons where they are at risk of abuse and assault and suicide. And it is one of the most heartbreaking areas of my practice, because when you put these young teenagers in spaces where they're going to be targeted and assaulted and abused for no good reason. I mean, you know, whatever the crime is that they've been accused of, we have no right to victimize people by subjecting them to sexual abuse and torture. And yet, that policy has not been completely eliminated because, again, I don't think we value the victimization of people who are accused of crimes in that way. And so that has to change. It is one of our top priorities.
Brian Stevenson. He's the founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, and the author of the best-selling book, Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. We spoke earlier this month, just before he spoke at an event for the Public Justice Center. We've got a link to details about the Equal Justice Initiative on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up a little later on this Memorial Day edition of Maryland Morning, a student from Baltimore makes her major motion picture debut as a young Nina Simone. Stay with us. On Monday mornings here on Maryland Morning, our theater critic, J. Wynn Russick, keeps us up to date on theatrical happenings across the Mid-Atlantic region. This morning, she brings us her review of the current production of the Maryland Ensemble Theater in Frederick, Superior Donuts.
You wouldn't expect it from the title, but there's a lot of violence in the play Superior Donuts. The opening scene takes place the morning after this Chicago donut shop has been vandalized. And there's a fight in the second act that almost has you ducking for cover. Playwright Tracy Letts started writing Superior Donuts right before his 2008 Pulitzer Prize winner, August Osage County, had its first production. He set out to write something very different from that sprawling Oklahoma family saga. And he did. In many respects, Superior Donuts is the superior play. Skillfully constructed and more tightly written, Superior Donuts strikes a credible balance between comedy and despair, brutality and hope. Its damaged, disparate main characters grow and learn from each other. And it incorporates broad, timely themes, ranging from racial understanding to corporate America's threat to small business. Director Janae Fauché's production at the Maryland Ensemble Theater in Frederick keeps you as keyed up as a strong cup of donut shop coffee. The play focuses on two characters. Arthur Shubashevsky is an aging hippie, son of Polish immigrants who opened the donut shop in 1950, the year Arthur was born. Franco Wicks is a 21-year-old African-American who comes in looking for a job. He challenges Arthur from the start.
Are you encouraging me to close my business, Franco Wicks?
I'm encouraging you to offer some heart-healthy alternatives, like some fruit or even some low-fat bran muffins.
Bran muffins.
If you want to stay in the world of the donut.
Hold on, this is your job interview.
How am I doing?
Oh, yeah, pretty good.
It's your lucky day, Arthur P. I'm a self-starter.
As played by Tad Janes and Najee Banks, Arthur and Franco journey from opposition to understanding. Janes, sporting a bushy gray beard, ponytail, tie-dyed T-shirt, and gruff exterior, looks and acts the part of a still disaffected draft dodger, a laconic loner. His co-star, Newcomer Najee Banks is a revelation. Banks imbues Franco with so much enthusiasm, he frequently breaks into song or dance or sends his voice into a near falsetto register. His character is brimming with ideas. He's written a novel, and he knows his stuff when it comes to literature. Much more so, he's convinced, than his new boss.
Can you even name any other black poets other than Langston Hughes?
Yeah, in fact, I can.
Go. Mm-hmm.
Is this a test?
Yeah! Yeah, this is a test! This is your racist test.
Oh, I have to take a racist test?
You said you weren't no racist.
Do you have to take a racist test?
You better reread Malcolm Arthur P. I can't be racist, I'm the oppressed!
But Franco doesn't just have a serious side, he's also in serious trouble. Trouble that tracks him down at the end of the first act. The involving plot comes complete with an O. Henry twist, but the connection that develops between Arthur and Franco is what makes you care about these seemingly opposite characters, the taciturn, introverted old guy and the talkative, outgoing young man. The play is peopled with other colorful Chicago types, from beat cops to the Russian owner of the shop next door. Though a few of the lesser performances aren't as strong, Laura Stark delivers a moving portrayal of a cop with a crush on Arthur, and Julie Herber stands out in the small role of a neighborhood bag lady. In designing the set and props, Ira Domser and Bailey Sterling paid so much attention to the details of this rundown donut shop, you're tempted to sit at the counter and order a cruller. Fight choreographer Mike Martin also earns praise. Friends, Franco tells Arthur, share their stories. In Superior Donuts, playwright Tracy Letts spins some satisfying stories, and they're well told at Maryland Ensemble Theater.
So your brother's bound and gagged, and they've chained him to a chair. Won't you please come to Chicago just to sing?
Superior Donuts is at the Maryland Ensemble Theater in Frederick until June 19th. We've got a link to details about tickets and showtimes on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews all things theatrical for us every Monday morning here on Maryland Morning. Thanks for being with us on this Memorial Day edition of Maryland Morning. Coming up a little later, a star is born. Vivi Etteme is a seventh grader from Baltimore who's landed a role in a new movie about Nina Simone. We'll meet Vivi Etteme after a break for the news. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. You may have heard about a new biopic about the legendary singer and pianist Nina Simone. If you have heard about it, chances are that you heard about the controversy surrounding the actress who was cast in the title role. Director Cynthia Mort chose Zoe Saldana, an actress whose appearance had to be substantially altered in order to make her complexion and facial features more closely resemble those of Nina Simone. That's a topic for a different day. What you may not know about the movie, Nina, is that it also features a talented student from right here in Baltimore. Vivi Etteme has been playing the piano since she was 4.5 years old. Now, she's a 13-year-old seventh grader at the Park School, and when she was 9.5, she was cast to play the role of the young Nina Simone in this movie. Here's a clip of the scene that opens the film. Young Nina is sitting at a piano on a stage in North Carolina in 1946 in front of a white audience. Her parents are standing at the back of the hall. She hasn't started to play yet, and a matronly white woman approaches her.
I would like my parents to have their seats up front.
It's illegal.
Dear, the whole town has come to see you. They're brilliant. You don't want to let them down. Okay?
I'm not playing unless they do.
After young Nina begins playing her classical piece, the scene transitions from North Carolina in 1946 to the Village Gate, a club in New York in 1965. Vivi Etemi plays the role of the young Nina Simone in this new biopic, Nina, and Vivi Etemi joins me in the studio. How you doing?
Good.
Congratulations. I've known you since you were a baby, and now you're a movie star. It's pretty exciting. This is great. So when you and your dad and your mom and your sister saw this on the silver screen for the first time, what was your reaction?
I was surprised. My parents were definitely going crazy.
Of course.
But it was kind of cool.
I mean, how long did it take? The scene is about 3 minutes longer, so how long did it take to film it?
It took a whole day.
A whole day?
Yeah.
So did you do it 10 times, 20 times? How many? Did you do it over and over?
Yeah, basically.
And how did the director interact with you, Cynthia Mort? Did she tell you something after each take, or did you do several takes in between the times that she would talk to you?
I did several takes, and then like she would come to me and maybe give me some pointers, or maybe the makeup artist would come and like adjust my hair because I was having problems with my hair. But it was definitely a really cool experience.
And what sorts of pointers did she give you?
Just relax, because I was really nervous.
Of course.
And I was playing the piano in front of a bunch of people I didn't know, and there were cameras, and I was just, it was nerve-wracking, but,
I mean, had you ever been on a film set before?
No.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's very, I would imagine, very unnerving. And you were really playing the piano?
Yes.
So the music that we hear in the movie, is that you really playing? Or did they dub that in?
They dubbed that in because they wanted to make the key change, like, coincide with the next scene.
Right, the scene in the nightclub.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so, like, what kind of day was it? What time did you start in the morning, and when did you go until the end?
I got up around 8, and then we went there maybe like around 10, and then like they gave me my lines, and then I practiced them, and then we had lunch, and then I had to like dress up, and they had to like do my hair, and it took like 15 minutes, and for the rest of the day I was just sitting on this old piano in this church, and
It's a lot of hurry up and wait, too, when you're doing movies, isn't it? Yeah. You were 9 years old. What did you know at that time about Nina Simone? Anything?
I didn't really know that much about her, actually. My mom had bought, like, her biography and a bunch of her albums, and I listened to some of her songs, but I didn't really know what they meant. I kind of liked her, I guess.
Yeah, of course, there was this big controversy that came out after the movie was made about Zoe Saldana. And to tell you the truth, the movie hasn't really gotten very good reviews.
No.
Although you got a great review in the Huffington Post. This guy named Dwight Brown said, Vivi Etemi as young Nina, refusing to play one note at a recital until her parents are placed in a good seat, is more reminiscent of Simone in a 3-minute scene than Saldana is in the entire movie. So you've got a better press than you've got better press than Zoe Saldana. Does that mean like you two can't hang out anymore?
I mean, Zoe Saldana, I think she's lovely, you know?
She is. She's a terrific actor.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you have a new appreciation for movies when you see other movies? You know, now that you've been, you know, in front of the camera?
I mean, yeah. I think that the whole idea of filming and producing and directing, like, it's such a long process. I used to think that, like, it would only take a couple months, but it takes years to really perfect something, like a vision that you have. So I definitely have a new appreciation. Yeah.
And even for short scenes, you know, 2 or 3 minutes worth in a movie can take a whole day, as you learned. So you think about a movie that's, you know, 2 hours long, that's a lot of days. Yeah. Of course, you're an experienced pianist. You've played recitals here and elsewhere. You've done a lot of piano playing. Do you now have the acting bug? Had you done any acting before?
No, not really. I mean, I'd never really had an experience with acting. I mean, I've always loved movies, like, as a kid, but, you know, just in general, no.
Yeah. I mean, your mom is a wonderful classical singer. That's how I know you, because I've known her, and we've done a bunch of concerts together. Your dad is a physician, but a music lover. You hung out at concerts with your mom, you know, all your life growing up. Is the stage a comfortable place for you? You like being on stage? You like performing?
I love performing, but it's... I mean, I think for every performer, there's always some nerves involved. So, like, but I just love music, and performing is also a great aspect of that.
Yeah, and so even though you hadn't acted before, they really hired you for this role because you are such a good pianist, right? What did you have to do in order to get the role?
I had to audition over Skype, and my parents taped me playing some pieces and sent it to them. And
then a star is born. Cool. Vivi, it's really terrific to see you in this movie, and congratulations. She's featured in the very first scene of the new biopic about Nina Simone called Nina. It's available for download. We've got a link at our website, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up next time, John Waters joins me to talk about the latest iteration of one of his biggest hits, Hairspray. He'll be narrating a production this week with the Baltimore Symphony. Plus, WIPR's Lisa Morgan introduces us to Andrew Oak, known as the First Ladies' Man. He'll talk about his book, Unusual for Their Time, On the Road with America's First Ladies. And theater critic J. Wynn Russick will have a preview of this year's Baltimore Playwrights Festival. Hope you can join us Wednesday morning on Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for spending part of your Memorial Day holiday with us. Have a great day. When you feel